It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We span the landscape of questions with a visit from the OBGYN and start with maternal care and high-risk pregnancies. Join in along the way with issues involving women's health in all stages of life, maternal and menstrual health, gynecological screenings, menopause, and more. 800-642-1234. Email those questions to ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Rebecca Scarseth is in the Obstetrics and Gynecology Department at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, where she specializes in high-risk pregnancies, infertility, and well woman care. Dr. Scarseth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with difficult pregnancies. The CDC saying about 1 in 4 women have difficulty getting pregnant or carrying a pregnancy to term. What is your first piece of advice for people who are struggling to get pregnant?
So when I have a patient come in for fertility evaluation, usually we start with some basic questions or looking at their medical history, how old the patient is, what their past medical history includes, if they have any other conditions like high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, etc. And we kind of get a full picture of who that person is and why they might be having issues. Are their menstrual cycles regular? We usually start with that initial evaluation first.
Initial evaluation. And, you know, sometimes infertility is labeled as, you know, air quotes here, a woman's problem. How true is that?
Good question. It's a very big misnomer. Only about a third of all infertility cases are truly a quote, as you put air quotes, a woman's problem. There's another third that's about the combination of the couple. And then there's another third that combines male plus unknown fertility. So everything could seem perfect on paper, but, you know, things just aren't lining up to get pregnant.
When you talk about age, it seems that the age of 35, or as they say, advanced maternal age, is like this magic number for a lot of things in your OBGYN area, from high-risk pregnancies to tests to, you know, to fertility. How significant is 35?
Good question. I know as we always giggle at this one, because many women come in and their advanced maternal age, at least they've gotten rid of the misnomer of geriatric pregnancy. But yeah, so 35 is when statistically women start to have a little bit higher risk of A, getting pregnant, and B, higher risk of having complications with the pregnancy. So the risk of genetic conditions rises kind of exponentially from 35 plus, but doesn't really escalate till over the age of 40. And then the risk of like diabetes, high blood pressure, preeclampsia do increase after the age of 35. So we just kind of keep that in mind as women are progressing through those pregnancies in that age group.
I want to get to preeclampsia in a moment, though. But, you know, how long should a couple be trying to conceive before seeing you? Typically.
Good question. Yeah. So most couples will get pregnant within the first 6 months. About 80% of couples will actually get pregnant within the first 6 months. For a couple where the female is less than 35, and really truly the male too, there's some male factor in fertility that starts to creep up after 35 as well. If they haven't been able to conceive within 12 months of trying to get pregnant with regularly timed intercourse, they should seek medical care. Now, if there's something that seems a little off, maybe menstrual cycles aren't regular or something else comes up that you're not being able to have regularly timed intercourse during ovulation, then definitely seek medical care. Now, if you're over 35 or 35 or older, I should say.
There's that number again.
Okay. I know. you should, if you haven't been able to conceive within those 6 months, then I would seek medical care and start talking to a physician. But anytime you don't have regularly timed regularly timed menstrual cycles within, you know, a couple of days, it's okay to be 2 to 3, 4, even 5 days off. But if they're really starting to become irregular, definitely seek out medical care.
We're talking about infertility, about pregnancy, general women's health questions with OBGYN Rebecca Scarseth at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. We had a question here. Carla in Fox Lake recently called into our program to ask a question about PCOS or polycystic ovary syndrome.
My daughter has PCOS. Polycystic ovarian syndrome, and has been told by several doctors that it's going to be difficult for her to become pregnant. I'm wondering if you can tell me either anatomically, chemically, on a molecular level, what is it about this syndrome that makes pregnancy difficult?
Dr. Scarseth?
Good question. PCOS is very much a misnamed syndrome. It is a it encompasses many different organ systems within the body, but one of them that it does target is the female reproductive system. And what happens in PCOS is that the ovaries aren't able to ovulate every month. In most women, there are some women who do have PCOS that can, so it gets a little bit tricky, but for the most part, it's the difficulty of the ovary actually releasing the egg. And a lot of these women have a hard time having a normal regular menstrual cycle. Sometimes they could go even up to years without having a menstrual cycle at all. And so these, I would definitely seek out medical care when and if these women are interested in conceiving, because there are tricks that we have that we can help them get pregnant with some medication that can help them with ovulation and to help them kind of create a fake menstrual cycle to be able to get that process going.
Are there ethnic or racial differences in PCOS symptoms?
For the most part, it's an imbalance of the hormones in the body.
Okay.
And so there can be some differences, but mostly it's some features that women may see. They might have some facial hair. They might have male pattern baldness. They may have increased acne. A lot of women with PCOS may be obese, although it doesn't necessarily cause PCOS or vice versa. But obesity does tend to correlate with PCOS.
Is there more research on the way about PCOS? What are you watching for or most interested in?
Oh, good question. I think there's going to be a change, or maybe not necessarily a big change, but the idea that PCOS isn't just a reproductive condition, that it really does affect the entire body, can increase cholesterol levels, increase risk of diabetes, anything associated with obesity, but it does affect multiple body systems. And that's what I really try to stress to my patients, is that this isn't just a reproductive condition, that it is a condition that can affect many aspects of their life, and how to manage that. And it's really a team approach between multiple different specialties.
Going back to the CDC saying that 4 out of 5 pregnancy-related deaths are preventable, what is most risky for people before and after pregnancy?
Oh, good question. The number one condition for causing maternal death is mental health conditions. And in reviewing this article that was put out by the CDC, I was trying to tease out if this was before or after, the pandemic. And this article is actually from before, which was even kind of more interesting, but really overdose, substance abuse, and suicide was the number one. We only have about 700 maternal deaths in the United States a year. So it's a pretty small number, but a large number of those women are related to mental health conditions.
Oh, that's interesting, because I thought you would go to preeclampsia and high blood pressure and those types of risks. But,
right.
That is really surprising.
Yes. Yeah. A combination of the ones that we see that are kind of most life-threatening immediately postpartum are the hypertensive disorders, the blood clots in the legs and lungs, and the postpartum hemorrhages. So those ones, I think, get more clout from us as we see them, immediately while a patient is in the hospital or shortly thereafter.
And in the hospital, that person may be given, I think, magnesium sulfate. Can you safely breastfeed if you were given that?
Good question. You can safely breastfeed with magnesium sulfate. We give it at a pretty high dose, so most women don't feel the best while they're on it, but it does help protect their brain from stroke and seizures, and that's the most important part of giving that medication. So we monitor those patients pretty closely, and they're usually only on that medication for about 24 hours after the delivery to help protect their brain from strokes and seizures.
Rebecca Scarseth is an OBGYN with Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, seeing patients involving high-risk pregnancies, infertility, well woman care. She's taking your questions on women's health and reproductive care. Call in with what you want to ask the doctor, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Whether it's a question about pregnancy or birth control, menopause, gynecological screenings, the OBGYN is here, is taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Rebecca Scarseth of Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse stays with us. Dr. Scarseth, the news this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approving pharmacies to offer prescribed abortion pills. What does that decision mean for people seeking abortion medication in Wisconsin?
Oh, good question. Currently in the state of Wisconsin, we are still under the act from, I think it's 1849. Yes. Mm-hmm. So right now we are still practicing under that act since the dissolution of Roe versus Wade. So this medication could help for both elective abortions as well as medical abortions from a miscarriage. And so we a good addition to have in our pharmacies to help women who are needing that care.
I wonder, how is your department managing patient options, decisions, obstetrical treatment paths, the ethics since the Dobbs decision? What is it doing differently since the fall of Roe?
We haven't really changed much of our practice in our particular clinic. We offer patients the services that they need depending on the location of where they live, and having the state of Minnesota close by to be able to provide those services if they need them.
So you have, because of being on the border there, you have leaned on Minnesota where they have more options?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. Let's take another call now. Shauna in Waukesha. Shauna, hi.
Hi, good morning. I had a question regarding birth control. I've been considering now, after two kids, starting birth control, but I have concerns about some of the side effects associated with it, like stroke and blood clotting. And so wondering if the doctor can speak to what types of birth control maybe have a lesser risk associated with them, or what is the risk in general? Is it high enough to warrant concern?
Shauna, great question. Dr. Scarseth, go ahead.
Great question. There are multiple different kinds of birth control. The ones that are most commonly associated with stroke and blood clots in the legs and lungs are the ones that have estrogen in them. So if that's a concern for you, and we do make it a I do discuss that with my patients as well. Those would be the ones to avoid. Usually women who are at a little bit higher risk for the stroke are those who are, again, here's that number, 35 years of age or older, who smoke cigarettes and or have high blood pressure. So we definitely try to avoid giving women with those conditions or that age of 35. It's too bad we can't have something positive about it, right? Those are the ones that we try to choose a different form of contraception. Ones that have less risk include IUDs. And so those are called intrauterine devices. They go inside of the uterus where the baby would grow and develop, so in our endometrial canal. And they can stay there for up to 10 years. The ones that are 10 years long are copper-based, so they have no hormones in them at all. And then Mirena, which is levonorgestrel IUD, put off by the Bayer company, and there's a sister to it called Lyletta. I can't remember the company that produces Lyletta, but both of them are the same level of hormone. Those ones are good for up to 8 years, and that was recently approved by the FDA, so it can protect you for up to 8 years. Very little hormone actually circulates in your bloodstream with those. Some people will feel some side effects of the progesterone, but mostly acts locally on the uterus, and it usually takes 3 to 6 months for the body to kind of adjust to having that hormone IUD inside of the uterus.
As you give all of these examples, it really speaks to Planned Parenthood saying there are at least a dozen different methods of birth control, including the pill and the shot and IUD. What are some things people should discuss with their doctor when considering what type of birth control to use?
Very good question. There's actually a chart put out by the CDC that kind of lists your risks and hormone with the different types of contraception. You can just Google CDC contraceptive charts, really great chart. And I use that frequently with my patients. And it kind of says, gives you a risk factor and if it's a good idea or not a good idea to use that medication based on what kind of medical history you have. And then I go over all of the different options. There's progesterone only, estrogen and progesterone, no hormones. And we go through all of those along with permanent sterilization if that's of an interest to the person or the couple.
Talking about women's health, answering your questions with OBGYN Dr. Rebecca Scarseth here, a physician at the Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. The number to call is 800-642-1234. We heard from Leslie in Milwaukee, called in our show recently with a question about the long-term health effects of birth control.
Hi, I just have a question about birth control. I know personally myself, I've been on birth control since I was in high school, and didn't realize how harmful it would be to my body at the time. I didn't know what questions to ask. And over 10 years later, I was still on the same pill, a hormonal pill, and started to do some own research into the effects that it has on my body, maybe some of the things that it's affecting my mood, my entire reproductive system. So I'm just wondering what research there is on the effects of that, how it's being taught to folks when they are asking for birth control prescriptions or more information, and what we can do to understand more about our bodies and the things that we're putting in our bodies and how they affect us.
Dr. Scarseth.
Great question. So I think a lot of times when women come in, especially young women come in and need contraception, either for contraception or need hormone regulation because their menstrual cycles are very painful, heavy, irregular, et cetera, it's a good conversation to have with the provider that's prescribing this medication or placing the medication inside of your body. Some of them that have a little bit more of a longer term effect include Depo-Provera. I always talk to women about this particular medication. Depo is an injection that's done every 12 weeks. And the longer that you're on this medication, it can decrease the chance of resumption of ovulation more quickly. So it's not a forever effect, but the longer you're on it, the longer it can take your body to resume ovulation afterwards. And I think it's just something that women need to go over with their physician on a regular basis, yearly by yearly. You know, I've been on this medication for 10 years. How's my blood pressure? How am I feeling on it? They definitely do change mood. That's a known possibility. And is there a better option for me? We have advances in these different forms of contraception that have occurred over the last, decade or two decades. So definitely some changes, definitely a conversation that you want to have with your healthcare provider.
And certainly, as the decades go on, I mean, if you're starting in your teens, this is definitely, checking in over those years, because things can change. And there are, as you have just discussed, so many different options.
Correct, correct. Even within birth control pills, it sounded like that caller was on birth control pills. There's different levels of estrogen that are available. There's different types of progesterone. Each of them acts a little bit differently. Each of them can affect a person a little bit differently. And so finding that perfect one for you, if that's the option that you're interested in, can sometimes be a guessing game. But at the same time, there are different options. So if the one that you're on doesn't seem to be working well, definitely seek out care with your medical provider.
Dr. Rebecca Scarseth, physician in the Obstetrics and Gynecology Department at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. We're visiting with the OBGYN about exams, regular screenings, infections, reproductive care. We'll get to managing menopause and the spectrum of women's health care. Join in with what's on your mind. Ask the doctor, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the OBGYN with us, hearing what's on your mind, from period cramps to pregnancy, what to expect from menopause. Maybe you have questions about finding an OBGYN or what you want to know to take charge of your next visit and feel comfortable with the provider. Call in with women's health questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Dr. Rebecca Scarseth in the Obstetrics and Gynecology Department at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Dr. Scarseth, let's talk about BV. The CDC reporting that bacterial vaginosis is the most common vaginal infection in women ages 15 to 44. There isn't a lot of understanding of what causes BV and how it spreads. Can you talk about what little is known about it and how you go about treating it?
Yeah, great question. BV comes up pretty frequently, almost daily in my office. And it's caused by a bacteria called Gardnerella. And this bacteria is actually a normal part of our normal vaginal flora. So we all have bacteria and yeast within the vaginal secretions, and it helps keep the normal environment. But when those bacteria overgrow, that's when we can find some irritation, and it can irritate the skin tissue within the vagina, which becomes very bothersome to women. And usually we end up having to treat it with either an antifungal for the yeast infection or an antibacterial for bacterial vaginosis. They can't pinpoint exactly why, but it's an overgrowth, and there's a lot of things that can lead to this overgrowth, various antibiotics, changes in hormone levels due to pregnancies, maybe at the cycle of your menstrual, where you're at your menstrual cycle, douching, spermicide, sexual intercourse, and other infections. So any imbalance in the body can lead to overgrowth of that bacteria.
Does it flare up again, even though you've treated it? Does it come back?
Yeah, so it can come back. And sometimes it can persist for months, which can be really bothersome to women. So we have some longer term treatment options for them, but usually just has to kind of run its cycle over those months, but it can be quite bothersome.
Yeast infections, they affect a lot of people as well. Yeast, as you mentioned, is always present in the vagina, and so is bacteria. How can women prevent the overgrowth of yeast and bacteria?
Good question. Really leaving the vaginal environment alone as much as possible, using as little artificial product in that region is the best treatment for it. Don't try to use those over-the-counter products that can, like Vagisil, can really kind of change that pH. Also, you know, if you have diabetes, keeping the diabetes under control, that can lead to increased yeast infections. Tight clothing can also increase the risk of both bacterial vaginosis and yeast.
And what about moisture, or, you know, maybe if you're like in the water a lot?
High sweat, yes.
Sweat, is that okay? So those are some issues where it might pop up as well.
Correct, yeah. So get those clothes off as fast as possible once you finish your workout. clean, you can take a quick shot, rinse, shower, and change your undergarments to avoid that extra moisture hanging around.
And it sounds like, too, you know, just water, maybe if you are sensitive, not using those maybe harsher cleaning products like particular soaps what would you recommend there?
Correct. Yep. So water, you could use a very mild soap, avoid ones with fragrances, sometimes those moisturizing, anything with added chemicals into it can cause more irritation.
Okay. Talking about women's health and common problems with Dr. Rebecca Scarseth. She's a physician in the obstetrics and gynecology department at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. And there's a line for you, 800-642-1234. Dr. Scarseth, let's talk about endometriosis affecting women and associated with extreme pain during menstruation. What is endometriosis?
Great question. Endometriosis is a condition where the lining of the uterus grows outside of the uterus. So most common sites that we see it's inside the abdomen. So it's not inside the uterus, it's outside of the uterus. It can happen in the ovaries, underneath the ovaries, in an area on the sides of our pelvis, behind the uterus where it attaches to the bowel. I would say those are the most common areas. And that's why women feel more pain during their menstrual cycles or even outside of their menstrual cycles because of that tissue that's growing outside of the uterus.
Can you discuss the signs and symptoms, what people should watch for?
Painful menstrual cycles, mm-hmm. pain with intercourse, pain with bowel movements and urination, especially during your menstrual cycles. And this can also, the hard part is some of these are also normal. So bleeding with bowel movements or urination, infertility, abdominal pain, fatigue, diarrhea, constipation, especially during the menstrual cycle, which again, just with the hormone changes and how the menstrual cycle occurs, some of these can be normal signs, but also if they're more intense, something to seek out for the diagnosis of endometriosis.
What about the fixes and surgical options?
Good question. It's really hard to diagnose endometriosis without surgery. Sometimes we can see it on an ultrasound, especially if it's in the ovary. Sometimes we can see it on a fancier imaging study called an MRI. The ones that we can see on MRI are usually the more advanced stages of endometriosis. And most of the time we have to diagnose via a procedure called a diagnostic laparoscopy, where we go inside the abdomen, take a look around and take tissue sampling and send it off to pathology and have them look at it under the microscope to diagnose the endometriosis.
How major of a surgery, or is it more of a micro? What can you tell us about that?
It can really vary. If there isn't any endometriosis in the abdomen, it's usually, maybe a week or 2 week mild recovery. You're not going to feel the best, maybe a little cramping in the abdomen for those couple weeks. Definitely know you had surgery. If it's a more extensive surgery where we're having to dissect out a different tissue, remove some tissue, then it can be a little bit longer recovery, maybe up to 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks.
What is the relationship between endometriosis and infertility?
So with endometriosis and infertility, sometimes what can happen is the fallopian tubes can get blocked. And so if the fallopian tubes are blocked, the egg is not able to release into the fallopian tube and meet the sperm at that location where conception starts. Women aren't able to get pregnant that way. Also, it can affect the menstrual cycle in general. And so if you're not regularly ovulating, you're going to have difficulties with conception as well.
Okay, let's take another call now. Felicia in Winona, Minnesota. Felicia, hi.
Hi, Felicia.
Oh, Felicia, I'm sorry. Okay.
No worries. Everybody gets my name wrong, but it's not nice to meet you, Dr. Scarsa. So my question for you is, my period stopped when I moved to Winona, Minnesota, in about a year and a half ago from Pennsylvania. I thought it might have been stress. I also stopped taking birth control at the same time. I just turned 48 then, so a little early for menopause, and I've had no menopause symptoms. Maybe I had a hot flash, could have been a short-lived fever. I've been always very physically active, like I could paddle 1,000 miles a summer without a problem. Within about 6 months of moving here, my feet and legs would start to go numb when walking. My muscles weren't getting nerve signals. I did go get MRIs and whatnot and so forth for that, and spoke to folks in the medical world. And I really can't walk two city blocks without symptoms, or a mile, then my legs start to give out. So apparently I found out that I have severe disc degeneration. And this is a big surprise to me because I've been so physically active my whole life. I mean, I take calcium, I drink milk, I do those types of things. So it didn't make that much sense to me. But I've been reading studies. Just last night I was reading studies about that there's links between decrease in estrogen for menopausal women linked to rapid disc degeneration. Is it how would I go about seeing if I could try hormone therapy for a few years to see if this remedies some of the disc issues that I have, even a small bit, or at least slows it down? I mean, I don't have any other reasons to try hormone therapy. The doctor and gynecologist both said, oh, you don't have symptoms? Wonderful. We don't, you know, only people need that have symptoms, and I have none.
Felicia, thank you for the question. Dr. Scarseth.
Yeah, great question. So the definition of menopause is 1 year without a menstrual cycle. 48 is actually not too early. It's on the earlier end, but the average age is 51. So we have some women who are 51, some women who are 45, some women who are 54. So you're definitely within that range of, the menopause years. And so you have to go 1 year without a menstrual cycle and not on any hormones. So that's a key. So if you're on the Mirena and you haven't had a period for 1 year, but you're 48, definitely not the same thing as without that Mirena IUD. It's not a question I get commonly as far as disc degeneration, but estrogen levels decreasing in the body can affect a lot of different organ systems. So it wouldn't surprise me if this was, related. I would talk to, your local obstetrician gynecologist about hormone replacement therapy, if you're a good candidate for it, and see if it helps improve your symptoms.
What are the impacts, the advantages, the disadvantages of hormone replacement therapy? Can you go into that a bit?
Sure. Yeah. So hormone replacement therapy is definitely the tailored hormone regimen. There's not a specific particular level that we look for because everybody's a little bit different, and we more so treat the symptoms than we do a particular level. And so a lot of times it's with estrogen, maybe a little bit of progesterone to help with protecting the uterus. And we want to look at the whole person. So we want to make sure that their cholesterol is okay, that we're not going to put them at increased risk for cardiovascular disease. And we don't want to use this medication past the age of 60 for the most part, because of the increased risk of cardiovascular events over the age of 60. There are some options that we have for women over the age of 60, including vaginal preparations to help with vaginal dryness, but the whole systemic ones, we really want to keep due diligence in using it as a transition period from menopause or through that menopausal timeframe.
Dr. Rebecca Scarseth, OBGYN in La Crosse, taking on all your women's health questions. And there's still time to talk and hear from you, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is an opportunity to ask La Crosse OBGYN Rebecca Scarseth any questions you have focused on women's health. There's still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Amy in Wausau. Amy, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. So I am 46 and I have two young children and I am exhausted. And I understand that part of that is just from having young children, but I'm also experiencing like perimenopausal symptoms. I have night sweats. I don't sleep well. I've had weight gain, and mostly it's the fatigue that I just is I'm having a hard time dealing with. So I actually have a wellness exam with my physician at the end of the month, and he's a family practice doctor. And I wanted to explore the hormone replacement therapy as well. But I kind of wanted to go in with a base knowledge. I feel like that would help me start the conversation.
Amy, thank you. Dr. Scarseth.
Great question, Amy. You are with probably 99.9% of us with the symptoms that you are feeling. Being a mother, and whether you're working at home or in the home or outside of the home, life is very busy and definitely leads to this exhaustion. Menopause itself, interestingly, does not cause the sleep exhaustion, but it's the symptoms that then cause the sleep disturbance that then cause the fatigue and exhaustion. So a few things that I always tell my patients to check in with outside of the hormone replacement therapy, because there's definitely a lot of good options there as well, include, you know, how much sleep are you getting at night? Are you getting some exercise throughout the day? What things could you get off of your load that don't mean as much to you? You know, is there something that you can do to offset the amount of things that you're doing within the day? The other good thing that you can do is if you want to Google Mayo Clinic and perimenopause, they have a great little website that talks about the different things that happen during perimenopause. And so that might be a good way to start with questions to your primary care provider.
So, you know, in addition to the night sweats, the, you know, the difficulty to sleep, what are, you know, irritation, what are some of the common symptoms people might face?
Good question. So hot flashes usually are kind of the number one symptom that we hear a lot of. Those can happen, as you said, during the day, during the night. They can range from once a month to multiple times a day. And it really varies woman to woman. And there's not really a way to predispose of, are you going to get them frequently or not? Other than, you know, sometimes if mom felt that way or sister felt that way, you might have the same, you know, symptoms as mom or sister. The night sweats that can awake people, and that's where they get those sleep disturbances, just not being able to get that good, restful sleep, and just having good sleep practices, you know, keeping the phones, the TVs, the lights and sounds outside of the bedroom, going to bed at a timely fashion, and getting trying to get good sleep and good physical exercise throughout the day. Decreased libido, and decreased estrogen in the vagina can make it dry and make it difficult for intercourse or more uncomfortable for intercourse. And then our body just changes. We get more adipose is the fancy word, but fat tissue around our abdomen. Our metabolism slows down. Our skin thins. Our hair thins. Those are just natural changes that occur during menopause.
Amy, thanks for the call. Let's go to John now in Green Bay. John, what is your question for the doctor?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm John, 40 years old. I have sexual partners in my life. And my question is, each of the five partners I've had say the exact same thing, that after a month or two of intercourse with me, I make them feel kind of yucky and smell funny, and they all have to go in and get some kind of medication to take care of the bacteria. So what's wrong with me? Why am I giving? I've never had an STD. They get tested. They don't have STDs. I don't know what's going on.
Great question, John. It could be going back to the beginning of this, or a few minutes ago when we talked about bacterial vaginosis. Sometimes the pH between two individuals might shift just a little bit and causes the women to have that bacterial imbalance inside of the vagina. Sometimes condoms can help. Sometimes they don't. I would definitely talk to your primary care provider or even a urologist to see if there's something else going on. Otherwise, it's just that pH imbalance between two partners.
John, thanks for the call. Let's shift now to mammograms. When are mammograms important for women to get?
Great question. So mammograms are definitely based on family history. Women who have a strong family history of breast cancer may need to get them before the age of 40. And then otherwise the recommendation by some of the societies is 40 and by some of other societies is 50. So I always talk to my patients candidly about that range between 40 and 50. I still recommend 40. We definitely have caught some breast cancers in the 40th years of life, not 35. No, I'm just kidding. But in the 40 years, in the 40s. So definitely would recommend at least a baseline screening mammogram around 40.
How do you teach people how to perform them at home?
Great question. Self-breast exams can be very intimidating for a lot of women. And so I tell women, you know what, the best self-breast exam is the one that you do, because if you don't do it at all, it doesn't help. So I tell them, find a way that works best for you. If you want to go up and down across the breast, around in a circle, spokes of a wheel, whatever makes you feel most comfortable is the better one than not doing one at all. Do they have to do it every month? No. I think just getting to know what your normal tissue feels like, doing it after your menstrual cycle, if you're not on any hormones, is the best time. If you do it right before your menstrual cycle, they'll be a little bit more tender, a little bit more lumpy, bumpy. Things to look out for: asymmetry. So if one breast has a lump or bump that's not on the other breast, definitely seek medical attention. If it's hard, fixed, and doesn't move, that's another concerning feature. And if you ever have just any questions or concerns, seek out the medical care. It's very easy for us to get an ultrasound and have you seek care with a breast specialist to make sure everything's okay.
And along those lines, what routine screenings for women do you find most important, and at what age?
So we start usually in the teenage years, and that's with STD screening. I talk to a lot of teenagers about how to protect themselves and their partners. Vaccines for Gardasil are very important to help protect against or decrease risk of cervical cancer. They're not 100%. They only protect against certain strands of HPV, and there are hundreds of strands that can cause cervical cancer. So taking away some of the more common and most aggressive versions is very important. Those screenings start at the age of 21. And then for women, you know, unless there's a risk of high cholesterol, we usually don't start that till your 30s or even 40s. And then breast cancer screening starts at around 40 to 50 years of age.
What about pelvic exams?
So the pap smear, we start at 21.
Okay. And, you know, we're almost out of time. Do you have any suggestions for how to be more comfortable when you go to your provider's office, and how to make this a lasting relationship with them?
It's really important to find a provider who works with your personality and takes the time that you need. Also, write those questions down that you have. I promise you, if you have the question, somebody else has the question, and you won't be the first person to say something to us that we haven't heard before. And so ask the question. It is, even if you're embarrassed, but it won't, any problem in life won't be solved unless you start seeking out the question or doing the research. And so that's my biggest recommendation for my patients is, unless you tell us, we don't know.
Just ask.
We do ask questions. Just ask. Yes, okay. We do ask questions, but we may not ask all the questions.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Rebecca Scarseth at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.